Okay, so we're ready to start 2 Chronicles chapter 16. And this is the last chapter and the end of what we have revealed to us about the reign of King Asa over Judah. So even though it's been a little while now since we were back in 1 Kings, we're studying 1 and 2 Kings together now along with 2 Chronicles. The vast majority of the material that we have in the Bible about Asa's reign over Judah is in these three chapters in 2 Chronicles, 14, 15, and 16. So we've got this last chapter to look at. We already saw what he told us about Asa in those verses that are within 1 Kings chapter 15. We looked at that first before these chapters in 2 Chronicles. Most of what is told about Asa's reign in that account in 1 Kings 15 are these events that we're reading about in chapter 16, a little bit from the end of chapter 15, but particularly what we're going to read here in the first part, where Baasha, the king of Israel, comes against Judah, or at least makes a problem for them when he built up Ramah, and so which was a big threat to Judah. And then Asa went and got help from the king of Syria and against the king of Israel. And the king of Israel ended up what he was trying to do, what Baasha was trying to do, failed. But the approach that Asa took in this case was not the right one, nor is it the right one that he takes after that. He's going to tell us about when he had a disease in his feet. So we have some situations here in chapter 16 that are displays of weakness on the part of Asa. Now, we saw in the previous chapter where he told us that his heart was perfect with the Lord all of his days. That was in chapter 15, verse 17. We noted that that is not the word for complete, spiritually complete. And this is a form of the word shalom, meaning peace or in safety. So he did not reject the Lord, but his faith was not in the Lord as it should be in these instances that we're going to read about here. So we're going to see some situations where he did not do as he should have done. So we can learn from that. We're also going to see, or we should be able to see, a connection between the weakness that we're going to read about in Asa's heart here with what was a perpetual or persistent problem with his son Jehoshaphat, who was also a righteous man, but Jehoshaphat had a very difficult time learning really the same lesson that his father needed to learn here, that is being taught here. So it will do us well to pay attention to this, because obviously if you have righteous men like Asa and Jehoshaphat that could have this weakness, it would be quite easy for us to do so also. So we need to be on guard against it, but this will give us an opportunity to learn some things that we can check ourselves on to make sure that our faith is fully in the Lord in every situation in our lives. This is near the end of Asa's reign, what we're reading about starting in verse 1. What this chapter is going to be telling us about, he's going to tell us in verse 1, this is in the 36th year of his reign, what happens here with Baasha. Now, just to remind, we haven't got to this part where we left off in 1 Kings in our study there about the kings of Israel. It just carried us to the point where Jeroboam died, and then Jeroboam's son became king after him, but his son was killed very shortly after he acceded to the throne. Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, was killed by Baasha, who was Jeroboam's military leader, and so he killed Jeroboam's son very shortly after he became king, and then he took over the throne himself. And then the same thing was going to happen to his son. This is going to start the process of the kings in Israel. We're going to see rapid turnover from one king to another, usually by violence, where we don't see a dynasty lasting more than a father and a son pretty much throughout the history of those kings, other than with Jehu, the one that the Lord used to destroy the house of Ahab for its wickedness. And as a reward for that, the Lord gave four generations after Jehu to reign over Israel. So that's really the only exception to this, what we're going to see, where the kingdom doesn't last in one family very long in Israel. Obviously, in Judah, it's entirely the opposite. It stays within one family, that being David's, and that's for a reason. So the descendants of David are the ones that continue to occupy the throne of Judah. But that's by God's design, by his promise, and what he fulfilled with Judah. So Baasha is going to be the actual third king of the northern kingdom of Israel, Nadab having that very brief reign. So Baasha, when he became king, he was overlapping Asa's reign. And so that's why we're reading about those two and the conflict between them here. But this is occurring in the 36th year of Asa. And back in 1 Kings chapter 15 and verse 10, it told us how long Asa reigned. And how many years was his reign over Judah? 41. So this puts us at the last 5 years of his very lengthy reign. And his life, which it's discouraging to see some of the lack of faith here in some of these situations that he's going to tell us about, but then also his stubbornness, and there's some pride on display here. So he's got some things that the Lord was working on with him before his life came to an end. But we're also going to see, as we mentioned, that this is going to some of this is going to plague his son Jehoshaphat after him. So let's even though we've read the parallel material in 1 Kings 15 about what happens here with Baasha, so this should be familiar to us. But let's read the account now that we have in 2 Chronicles chapter 16 about this. Let's first read verses 1 through 6. Let's see, Brother Stephen, can you read that for us, please?
In the 6th and 30th year of the reign of Asa, Baasha, king of Israel, came up against Judah and built Ramah to the tent, that he might let none go out or come in to Baasha, king of Judah. Then Asa brought out silver and gold out of the treasure of the house of the Lord and of the king's house, and sent to Benadad, king of Syria, that dwelt at Damascus, saying, "There is a league between me and thee, as there was between my father and thy father. Behold, I have sent thee silver and gold. Go break thy league with Baasha, king of Israel, that he may depart from me." And Benadad hearkened unto the king Asa and sent the captain of his army against the cities of Israel, and they smote Izon and Dan and Abelmaim and all the shore cities of Naphtali. And it came to pass when Baasha heard it that he left off the building of Ramah and let his work cease. Then Asa the king took all Judah, and they carried away the stone of Ramah and the timber thereof, wherewith Baasha was building, and he built therewith Geba and Mizpah.
Okay, so here's the problem that arises because of Baasha, the king of Israel. So there is this rivalry that began immediately with the split in the kingdom after Solomon died, when you had Rehoboam, Solomon's son, become king over Judah, and then the 10 tribes of the north rebelled against him by God's design. It was of the Lord as part of the punishment for Solomon, what he had done in turning to idols, though he repented of that. But that punishment was invoked by God, and it was also a punishment for Israel for following in that turning to idols. So that was of the Lord, the split in the kingdom, which is why he forbade Rehoboam from fighting a war when that split occurred and the 10 tribes chose Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, to be their king. There was about to be a massive war in Israel, and God forbade Rehoboam from doing so because this was of him. But with that situation, with that split right there, I mean, they were instant enemies. So there was rivalry between the two thrones, and that has persisted up to this time, now being Baasha and Asa. So Asa is the third king of the southern kingdom, Judah, and Baasha is the third one in the northern kingdom of Israel. But that conflict that has been in existence from the beginning when that split occurred is still persisting. We saw a bit more of that when we were studying about, when it told us that Rehoboam and Jeroboam had they fought all of their days. And then Rehoboam's son was also, his son Abijah also was in conflict with Jeroboam. And we saw an example of that in chapter 13, where there was a battle between those two. Well, now it's Baasha and Asa. What's finally going to bring that that rivalry to an end?
And Asa buys off.
Well, that's going to end this situation, but I think we can see that the king of Israel, that Baasha, wasn't feeling too good about the situation. It worked for Asa, but what's going to end the enmity between the kings of Israel and Judah? What's going to stop them from fighting with each other? It's going to be Asa's son Jehoshaphat. What did he do? How did he solve the problem? A marriage. I mean, how long has that been? I mean, who were Solomon's wives and why? He married those 700 wives that were princesses. So, I mean, how long has the practice been when you have nations that have conflict that it gets settled by when you have monarchies where they marry into each other, and so then that that brings peace? I mean, that's a political move. I mean, that's as old as having kings. So that's what ends up happening. So that's an expedient. That's a way of getting rid of conflict. And that's what Jehoshaphat's going to do. But as we mentioned, Jehoshaphat in doing that is really perpetuating or continuing this problem that we're reading about here with what his father did. So his father settles this conflict by a political expediency. I mean, there are different ways of solving conflicts between nations. Getting another ally to help you where against your enemy. I mean, does that still happen? I mean, yeah, that still happens. That still happens right to our present time. Or the other thing that we talked about, having a marriage between rulers of rival nations, kingdoms. I mean, that. So some of these things. Those are ancient practices that the nations of the world have engaged in. We're seeing Asa do that. Well, on one level, we can say, well, he was pretty wise. He got the king of Syria to help him and solved his problem with the king of Israel. This isn't a good thing, especially when we understand why. What was the seed or the root of the conflict between Israel and Judah? I mean, well, somebody, you might say, well, because those 10 tribes rebelled against the house of David. True enough. But what was the real rivalry at this point? What did the prophet that came to Asa in the previous chapter, in 1 Kings chapter 15, I mean 2 Chronicles chapter 15, what were his words to Asa? It was after he had won that battle against the Ethiopians, and that's going to be brought up by another prophet here to remind him after this situation here in 2 Chronicles 16. Involving Baasha and his decision to go get the Syrians to help him. And he's going to be reminded by God's prophet about what had happened, what God had done for him before with the Ethiopians. Did he need to enlist the help of some ally like the Syrians or anybody else or the Egyptians or somebody to help him against the Ethiopians before? No. God helped him. He didn't need, when God was on his side, he didn't need anybody else. And he's going to, that same thing is here. I mean, but before we get into the details of how he should have solved this problem, what is the real problem? What did the prophet that came to him in chapter 15 after that victory over the Ethiopians to encourage Asa, and it succeeded, encourage Asa and all the people to continue to seek the Lord, and they did so. But you remember back in verse 2 of chapter 15 when he told him, the Lord is with you while you be with him. If you seek him, he'll be found of you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you. And then he gives a practical example about what was going on with their neighbor to the north, with Israel. In verse 3 says, now for a long time Israel has been without a true God and without a teaching priest and without law. Does that still describe the situation when we get to chapter 16? Yes. That goes back to the very beginning of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat's reign, and all the things he told us about that he did in 1 Kings chapter 12 when he created his own religion in his kingdom, which was, in his mind, going to protect his throne. Whereas, in reality, of course, it hastened its destruction, but he made an entirely new religion with those golden calves, those two that he made, but one in Dan, one in Bethel, made up his own priests, his own feast days, had his own altar, all of that, forbade his people from going to Jerusalem, like the Lord commanded them to worship the true God in the place that he designed, on the days that he designed it, with the priests that he authorized. But Jeroboam opposed all of that. And that's why the righteous ones in his kingdom, many left at the outset when he did all of that and joined themselves to Rehoboam there in Judah, right there in those first 3 years when all that was going on. And then we saw that in Asa's time, with him following the Lord and his people with him, there are many more that now come out of the north because of that situation. There was a spiritual division there. The northern kingdom is without the true God right now. They have forsaken him. That's the whole point about if you forsake him, he'll forsake you. And God had forsaken them because they had forsaken him. They were without the true God, not because God just on his own up and left. God doesn't do that. That was his point. If we are with the Lord will be with us. And if we seek him, he'll be found. So does God go hide himself from those who are seeking him? Or does he forsake the ones who are drawing near to him? He doesn't do that. He did then, he does it now. So if anyone, whether it's an individual or if it's a family or a nation or the world as a whole, being without the true God means they have rejected him. And that's what had happened in Israel. They had forsaken the Lord and rejected him. And so they had chosen to not be with him. They had chosen to be without the true God. They had chosen to be without law. They had rejected God's law, and they had rejected his priests that were the ones he designed to teach his law in their land. They made up their own priests that were teaching something else. So that was the situation. So there's conflict because there's a spiritual division there. Now even Rehoboam's son Abijah highlighted that in chapter 13 of 2 Chronicles, in that chapter that gives most of the information we have about him. And he highlighted, acknowledged, underscored that particular spiritual division was there. We've got the right, we have the true God, we have the right priests, we have the temple, we have the sacrifice, we have all of that, which was true. Now the problem with Abijah was what? He was a hypocrite because he wasn't keeping God's commandments. But when he's pointing out why God was against Israel, and it was the reason he gave Judah a victory that day in spite of their king being a hypocrite, it was true. There was a spiritual division there. If anyone in any Israelite was going to be keeping God's commandments, where would they have to be? They would have to be part of the kingdom of Judah. They couldn't do that in the northern kingdom because of their rejection of God and his law. So how does... And this is where it becomes very important for this lesson. That particular division that was in the nation of Israel, which was the nation that God had made his covenant with, and they were brethren. They were the children of Israel, the name that God gave to Jacob. So they were brethren. So this was division in a very large family. How was that to be solved? And the reason why we're studying this, the reason why God teaches us about this, is because this kind of spiritual division and conflict is going to confront us all. We're all going to be faced in some manner with situations akin to this, where we're going to have problems with somebody or a plurality of people based on these issues, whether because we're following the Lord and they're not, there's going to be a problem. And usually that problem, that conflict is going to be where? In our families. Now, is that just what I think? It's true, but who's the one that told us it would be that way? We have so many examples in the Bible of it, but who was the one that told us that's the way it would be? Well, of course, it's Christ. He was the one that warned us about where our problems are going to be. In Matthew chapter 10, if we can go there. We're going to start here because this is going to be our foundation. This is the faith. These are the words of God that we should hear, and by hearing, have faith in God, that we will then act upon, obey, so that we do the right thing in these situations. But this is what Asa is not going to do, and his son is not going to do in cases that we're going to be reading about. Let's go ahead and start with verse 25. He's going to very plainly state what our purpose is as a disciple of Christ. And then he's going to teach from there who we need to fear, who we need to follow, and when there is a problem, the right way to handle it when there's a spiritual division. So that's going to be verses 25 through 39. Brother David knows a lengthy reading, but could you read that for us? Matthew 10, 25 through 39.
Servant as his Lord. If they have called the master of the house to help them, how much more shall they not that I have come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her, against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man slew shall be they of his own household. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he that taketh not his cross and followeth after me is not worthy of me. He that findeth his life shall lose it, and he that loseth his life for my sake shall find it.
All right, so when he's teaching us there what our purpose is as a disciple, that's to be like the master. Well, if he's our master, who are we going to be? Who are we going to be living for? Who are we going to be serving to seek to be like him? I mean, there's our entire purpose, but we have to forsake everything to do that. We can't have another master. And so we need to... Well, what about when we get persecuted for doing that? That's the point there. Well, we're going to have men that will oppose us. Should we be afraid of them? Not why? No, of course. Why, well, what's the reason? Is it because they can't do anything to us? Well, they can do a lot of things. But what's the maximum that any man can do to us? Yeah, they can kill us. That's the maximum. I mean, that's a pretty big maximum. We understand that, but we don't want that to happen. However, that is the maximum that any person can do to us if that is the Lord's will. Of course, they can't even do that. They can't do anything without it being the Lord's will, but that's the most that could be done, is that they could kill our body. And that's happened to a lot of God's followers before. But what can they do past that? And anyone that's going to be steadfast and unmovable and always abound in the work of the Lord and have their faith in Him and never forsake Him, when that death occurs, then what happens? Well, that's the end of this life, but what about eternity? I mean, man can't touch us there. And the devil can't. He's using these situations to bring temptation. But we need to be concerned about the one who has power over our soul and where we spend our eternity. That's the one we need to fear. That's the one we need to serve. And he reminds us of his love for us and how important we are to him, as he knows every hair on our head. And not a sparrow falls without the Father, so nothing's going to happen to us without him. But that's the one that we need to be concerned with. But then verses 32 and 33 go along with that. What's the temptation when people are opposing us?
To go along with society and the crowd and deny.
Yeah, to deny him, keep quiet about it. I mean, it happened to Peter, didn't it? That's going to be the temptation. But if we won't confess that we're his when the heat is on, I mean, when it comes time to it, we're before Christ on the day of judgment. Is he going to confess us before his Father? If we deny him, he'll deny us. These principles go right back to what we were reading in 2 Chronicles 15 with the words of that prophet. And then he tells us there in verse 38 that, or verse 34 rather, now Christ is the Prince of Peace. But who did he come to make peace with? Between us and whom? Us and his Father. Us and God. So he's brought the way to reconcile us to God when we were his enemy because of our wickedness. So he's brought the way for us to be at peace with the Father. That will also bring us into peace with all those, everybody else who's at peace with him. So we'll have peace with one another on that basis. That's the right basis of peace and unity, is when we're all in agreement that we're going to follow the Lord and obey him and serve him. But as far as bringing peace between us and the world, is that what Christ came to do? No. In fact, he is going to divide us and separate us from the world. Well, when we come out from the world, when we forsake this world and everything because we're, when we turn to the Lord, then now we're different from those that we were a part of, that we were in agreement with previously. Well, and how are they going to respond to that when we are no longer following those ways anymore? And especially in our own families. That's what he says. He's come to bring a sword and divide families. That's where the division and the conflict is mostly going to occur. Most of our problems in relationships on this earth, should there be any other reason why we are in conflict with anybody else other than because of our following what is right when they're not? If we've got some other reason why we're in conflict with somebody, then we need to fix that, because that's not a right reason. That should be the only reason that we're divided from someone over the Lord's truth. But that's going to happen. And principally, where is that going to happen? Most of our problems are going to occur with relatives. The saddest is really sad when it's when there's a division and it's between husband and wife. That happens sometimes. But if the only way that we can serve the Lord, or you could put it another way, the only way that you could have peace with your spouse is by forsaking the Lord. I mean, then what do? If it's the choice between God or your husband and wife, who's our master? It better only be him. And the same is true whether it could be a parent, it could be a child, it could be our siblings. I mean, somewhere it's going to happen, and we're going to have conflict and division because of our decision to serve the Lord and to live for him. And if we choose man over God, or anything over the Lord, we're not worthy of him. So that's the Lord's truth right there. Well, there's conflict here in within Israel, within this large family, the children of Israel, and 10 tribes have forsaken the Lord. And they're without the true God. They're without his law by their own choice. So how's that division going to be healed? And it's manifesting itself here in Asa's time with Baasha coming against him. Well, there's only one way to solve the problem. The only way that there's ever going to be unity, there are two ways it could be solved. If we have conflict with somebody because of we're following the Lord and they're not. What are the two ways that conflict disappears? There are only two ways to do it. Either we, what? Or they repent and turn to the Lord. I mean, those are the only two ways. Now, there's only one right way that should happen, and that's for them to repent and turn to the Lord. Problem solved. But if we solve the problem by us going to them, that's what Matthew 10 was warning us against. We're no longer worthy of the Lord, but that's not the right way to solve or to come up with unity, by our forsaking the Lord's truth for the sake of that peace and unity. That was something that the Lord warned the prophet Jeremiah about. And we will hear him referred to by some as the weeping prophet, mainly because he was inspired to write the book of Lamentations. But he had plenty to lament, didn't he? He lived many years. He was, going back to chapter 1, he was still a child when the Lord called him to be his prophet. And he had a long career as a prophet of the Lord. Many decades where God inspired his words through Jeremiah to the people of Israel. But it was when Israel, and now of course Judah is the only one left. This is after those 10 tribes in the north finally were destroyed for their wickedness that we're reading about in the early days right now in our study here. But as that persisted, they never repented of that. Eventually the Lord destroyed them. And they were sent off, and most of them died, but whoever survived was taken by the Assyrians. They were assimilated into their kingdom. Well, there was no spiritual distinction between them anyway, so the whatever physical distinction was there disappeared rapidly. They're known to history as the lost tribes of Israel. They never came back. That was it. They were done. So Jeremiah lived, those are the people he was prophesying to. So how many allies did Jeremiah have? His scribe Barak, and then later we read about Ebed-Melech that saved him from the mire. Do we read about any other ally that he had other than those two? No. And that's what he references in Jeremiah chapter 15. When here Jeremiah was, now how easy would that be to spend decades having to preach God's word? If I came in here this morning and I knew, of course there would be no reason for any of you to show up in this case, but if I came here and I knew all of you were going to be hating everything, when I was preaching God's word, you were going to hate everything, every scripture I read, and you were going to fight me tooth and nail all the way over it. Or if it were the other way around, I mean, how much joy would be in that work? And imagine you have to do that day after day, year after year, decade after decade, and that's what you got to do. And you're the only one. You're fighting alone against that, and they're trying to kill you for it. The Lord said, if you be faithful, I will not let them kill you. They tried. The Lord was with them and delivered them. But that was the situation that Jeremiah had throughout his life. That's what he's referring to here in chapter 15. And Jeremiah is speaking about the what his situation actually was in verse 17. And let's read 17 through 19, and we can see what his situation was and what God said about it. Brother Glenn, can you read Jeremiah 15, 17 to 19?
I said, not in your assembly the waters nor rejoice, set alone because of thy hand. For thy house filled me with indignation. Why is my pain perpetual and my wounds to be cured, which refuses to be healed? Wilt thou be altogether as he is a liar and as the waters that fall? Afterward, thus saith the Lord, if thou return, then will I bring thee again. Thou shalt stand before it, and if thou take forth the precious from the vial, then shalt be as my mouth, and thou shalt be as my mouth. Let them return unto thee, for return not thou unto them.
So it was Jeremiah, was he united with his people? His fellow Israelites. No, he was not. How does he describe all those people that were there in Jerusalem at that time that he was prophesying to? They were an assembly of what? An assembly of mockers. So here you had Jeremiah over here by himself. He said, I sat alone because of your hand. And you had the rest of them, this assembly of mockers. And he said, I didn't join myself with that assembly of mockers. See, that was, he could have, the problems he had, the conflict that he had with all of his neighbors, he could have solved that very easily. All he had to do was go join them and become another mocker. They would have received him gladly, and he would have been fine with them, right? But then he would have had a problem with whom? And that's the point. What did God say? He told him the only right way that conflict could be resolved. What did he say not to do? Return not thou to them. What did he say? What was the solution? He said, let them return to you. Return not thou to them. Don't you go their way. Don't have unity because you go to them and become another mocker. They need to come and be with you in serving me. So there was what God said about that. That's the only way to resolve spiritual conflict, that we have to be united in serving God. There are a lot of... This is a very pertinent issue. There's been a lot of cases because, you know, there's religious division out there in our society, as there always is. But we've had many of our own brethren that have decided they want to get along with other religions by doing what? Going their way. Going along with their false doctrines and practices. It started in the 80s with the term, it was called having unity in diversity. That makes no sense, does it? Having unity in division. I mean, that's really what that meant. In other words, we're going to ignore all these differences and we're just going to get along. Well, that's because that's when you forsake your stand for the truth and teaching it and practicing it and going the other way. I'm sure my father-in-law wouldn't mind me telling this story, but back when he was, I think it was in Conroe, Texas, when he was had not been preaching for a long, long time. But there was a college. Where was that? Anyway, somewhere in Texas. There was a college there in the town where he was preaching, and so the Methodist, most of the denominations in the town, they had a what they call a Bible chair. They had essentially an office on that campus of that school, that college, where they could try to promote themselves to the students and have students to come to try to draw them. The Methodist preacher came to Brother Johnson because they didn't have one. And they didn't want to have to bear all the expense and everything of running that themselves. So he tried to see, he made the proposal to have the Church of Christ there to go along to join in the Methodist, and that they would have it together. And so Brother Johnson asked him, well, how can we do that when you believe one thing, we believe something different? He said, we're just going to, he said, you can just believe what you want to believe and we'll believe what we believe. And he said, but I believe you're going to hell. And he said, well, you can't believe that. But anyway, he said that, I mean, that proposal quickly died. But I mean, that was a situation. It was like, well, yeah, you can get along with them. You can go in and be fine if you forsake the truth and you forsake your beliefs, what God teaches. But you can't do that, can you? Jeremiah was told not to. Well, Jehoshaphat's going to have this problem, but it's going to start with his father. So when Baasha comes and builds up this city, what was the right thing, the right way to handle this problem that he had with Israel? Well, it was not by forsaking the truth. And he doesn't do that. He doesn't say, well, I'm no longer going to believe the Lord. I'm going to go along with all these wicked practices of my brethren here to the north. He didn't do that, which was good. But the way to solve this particular conflict was to recognize the very root of it, and it has to do with having your faith in God and serving Him. That was the reason why the Ethiopians came against. It was a test of his faith that we read about back in chapter 14. And what did Asa do at that time? And what did he tell the people to do? Do you remember that? When the Ethiopians came and Asa had his faith in the Lord, and he told them that back in 2 Chronicles chapter 14, in verse 11, Asa cried to God, And he said, there's nothing with you to help, whether with many or with them that have no power. Help us, O Lord our God. And God did. Now, is that still true, what he said two chapters ago? But he doesn't follow that here. Instead of going to the Lord in about this situation and saying the same thing, he goes to the king of Syria for his help. Help me break your alliance with the king of Israel, because you had, if we just, you know, you have Israel here at this time, and it's the Sea of Galilee, you have the Dead Sea, and you have, so here you have Judah, and here you have Israel. And up here you had Syria. So these two were in league together here. Well, that's a pretty powerful combination. But not against God. But Asa decides to go, he buys off the king of Syria to break his league with the king of Israel, so that the Syrians then help Judah against Israel. And so Syria goes and invades up here in the north, because the problem Asa has is down here. And so the Syrians come up here, and so Israel's got to draw all their strength away from the border with Judah to go deal with the Syrians. That pulls them away from Judah. I mean, it worked, but it's only because the Lord let it work. But it was not his solution to the problem. It wasn't God's solution to the problem. It's much like in chapter 13, when Abijam, Asa's father, who was a hypocrite, went against Israel, against Jeroboam. Well, he was a hypocrite. If God were going to make the decision about who was going to win that battle based on strictly on the kings, I mean, you had one that completely had rejected God. You had another one who wasn't obeying him and gave him lip service. Yet neither one of them served the Lord. But he gave Judah victory, and it wasn't because of Abijam. Well, here he's going to give Asa, he's going to give him deliverance from Baasha, but is it an endorsement of the way that Asa chose to handle this situation? No. And he's going to send a prophet to him about that very matter, which is what's going to come in the next verse. And we'll see that in verses 7 through 9. As he's going to tell him, you should have done what you did when the Ethiopians came against you, and you would have had the same result. He didn't need help from the Syrians to solve that problem. God solved the problem with the Ethiopians without anybody else. Why would God need Asa to get the... And he had to give him those things out of the temple to get him to agree to do it. So that was a very wrong move on Asa's part. And he was not showing the kind of faith he needed to in that situation, like he had shown the right faith in chapter 14. So he's going to be reminded of that next. But we'll have to save that reminder for next Lord's Day, Lord willing, because we're out of time. But we'll stop there and continue that our next time together, Lord willing.